Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to do a audio commentary for the what's considered by many to be the best episode of Star Trek, written by Brian Fuller, Living Witness.
Season 4, episode 23, I think?
Yes, yes. Of Star Trek Voyager. But before we get into that, let's talk about some of the stuff that Brian Fuller is working on now in the world of Star Trek, shall we?
Yeah, it seems to have grabbed a few headlines.
Star Trek Discovery, the new show, is slowly working its way towards principal photography, or whatever you want to call it. And yeah. At the TCAs, Brian Fuller revealed a bunch of information about the new show, a couple things which are interesting to us in particular are the setting and the character breakdowns a bit. So this setting here is going to be, he says, about 10 years before Kirk's 5-year mission, which seems to be right around 2255-ish, which means that the Enterprise is going to be flying around out there with Captain Pike in command and, you know, Lieutenant Spock as his science officer and all that good stuff. So who's to say that they won't encounter the Enterprise at some point and maybe even run into Prime Captain Pike and Prime Lieutenant Spock, who conveniently are almost exactly the same age as their Kelvin timeline counterparts are, you know, in terms of real world actor stuff.
Yeah, that would be very cool.
So maybe, you know, we could have Bruce Greenwood and Zachary Quinto, and who knows who else, you know. I mean, I guess Kirk is, what, like an ensign or a lieutenant or something on, what is it, the Farragut and stuff? So you could theoretically do a little bit of crossover stuff here in a very weird and interesting way.
I would be very interested to see them simply cast other members of the Enterprise crew from that time period with Captain Pike, yeah, but especially the old Doctor. Would be very interesting.
Yeah, you could get the old Doctor. You could get Number One, of course.
Number One would be great. Although, who could you possibly find to, you know, go into the Majel Barrett role? You know, like, who could you?
I think once you've recast Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, recasting...
Oh, I'm not saying that it's impossible. I'm saying that, like, who would you? Who would you put in there? I already know, with it being a Fuller production, who I'd put in there.
Okay, well, who would you put in there?
I forget the actress's name now. My apologies, but the lead from Wonderfalls.
Oh, okay,
I'd have her in that role.
Yeah, I forget her name too. But yeah, I could see that.
And there is your Fuller connection. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who hasn't seen Wonderfalls, she was Will's friend who turned evil in season 3 of Hannibal.
Yeah, so she's been in a number of Fuller productions. You know.
Yeah.
Someone asked him, they're like, what about Amanda Grayson, Spock's mom? You know, you could get Winona Ryder to play her. And he's like, yeah, that'd be awesome. But yeah, you could get her. I mean, there's lots of people who you could theoretically tie in with. And I mean, someone who, you know, last week we talked about this, but with sort of without the knowledge of when this show takes place exactly. But, you know, apparently Fuller and Scott Bakula have talked about the potential of Bakula returning as, in this case, Admiral Archer, you know.
Oh, that would be so cool.
He'd be much, much older and everything. And, you know, like we said last week, you know, Bakula was like, don't make a big deal out of this. It's not like it's a done deal or anything. We're just saying that if we wanted it to happen, it would be pretty easy to make it happen. you know?
And as I recall, there were conversations with Nicholas Meyer that started around the same type of vein and turned into Meyer working on the show.
So there you go, you know?
There you go.
Hey. So yeah, that could be interesting. The other thing which is interesting is that it is confirmed that the lead character is going to be a woman and that she will not be the captain. She's going to be a lieutenant commander.
I like that.
I like it too, you know? I mean, is this going to be like Lower Decks the series? That'd be awesome.
What? Why not? Well, I mean, the thing is, I think with a character who's not... we've seen enough people in the captain role. I think it would be much more interesting to see somebody who has, like, their storyline is a little freer. They're not as tied to the bridge as the captain needs to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the difference even. I mean, yes, he still went away on away missions and stuff like that. And so did, you know, Janeway and stuff like that. But look at the difference in the way Janeway and Picard were in that role as opposed to, like, a Riker or... even a Paris, you know, like somebody who can leave the bridge on a more frequent basis. So I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's this kid that I know who he's just started watching Star Trek, you know, like the original series primarily. And I was talking to him about this and he's like, well, who would the equivalent be? You know, in terms of like, it's not the captain, who would it be? And I was like, I guess it would probably be, you know, taking into account the rank, probably someone along the lines of Scotty, you know, or for Next Generation, yeah. Like Data. Like, probably mm-hmm. not the first officer, but maybe, like, the second officer, you know?
Right.
So that's...
yeah, that makes sense.
That's interesting. You know, that does give you a bit of leeway and stuff, and, you know, it allows you to see what's going on off of the bridge occasionally and that sort of thing. So that's cool.
Yeah.
It's exciting. It's exciting, you know? I don't know. My guess of Tracy Toms, you know, I think maybe... I'm still sticking to it because when it happens, I want to be like, oh, yeah, I called it. But since she's a bit older, you know, I think, mm-hmm. you know, especially since in a lot of things they seem to be skewing younger, you know, I could see her as a captain. But I can't mm-hmm. really see her as, like, a lieutenant commander because I imagine... that the person who they would get would probably more likely be in their, you know, late 20s or early 30s, whereas, you know, Tracy Toms is a little bit older than that, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. But whatever it is, it's exciting. He says we're probably going to get more info in, like, October or something. I imagine that might be the next time they officially announce stuff, but if they're shooting in September, like... the trade magazines and stuff are surely going to find stuff out before
well,
that.
Well, why wouldn't they make some announcements around the original air date?
That would make sense, you know, or maybe they're going to wait. And
happy 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Here's your new cast.
Yeah, that'd be great, you know. Maybe they'll do it the week before at the convention in New York, you know.
Yeah.
Who knows? But it's exciting, for sure. For sure.
I definitely think it's exciting. And did you see the makeup test that he tweeted out, the picture of it?
Yeah, yeah. With the antennae. Do you think that's an unpainted Andorian, or do you think it's a
you
new
know,
race?
First thought that came to my mind was Andorian, because he also seems to have applied a filter to it when he put out the picture. And, you know, Andorian would be great, but Andorian would also kind of be like, oh, well, okay, we've seen them before. Like, he's promising a lot of, you know, he said there are going to be a lot more aliens and, you know, some weirder aliens on this set than, you know, previous episodes have had. Like, he's going to take advantage of the production value and the ability to actually have alien species scattered throughout the Federation.
So, one thing that we do know for sure is one of the people who's going to be working on the visual effects on this show is a guy named William Pawlowski, who is a visual effects producer slash supervisor who has been working in the industry for a very long time, since, you know, the 90s at least. But in recent years, he's become a visual effects producer in television, having worked on a lot of high-profile shows, including Pushing Daisies for Brian Fuller, Weeds, Better Call Saul, the new X-Files revival, and Breaking Bad, which he was nominated for an Emmy for the season 4 finale, Face Off, which is an awesome episode.
Isn't it just? Yeah.
It is, and it has some pretty interesting visual effects in there as well. So he's working on the show, and I mean, it makes sense since he's obviously got the Fuller connection with Pushing Daisies and everything like that. So that's pretty exciting. One of the things which is kind of interesting is if you look at his Twitter feed, about a week ago, he started posting links to job postings for various positions on the visual effects staff for the new show. So if you're a visual effects guy or girl and you have a desire to work on the new Star Trek show, check out William Pawlowski's Twitter feed, and you know,
and we'll be your agents.
Yeah,
Stage 9 will be your agents.
Yeah, you'll have to come on to the show to talk to us. You know, once all is said and done, but yeah.
Think about that. We'll be your agents, and you don't even have to pay us. You just have to come on the show and give us the skinny on how things work.
Yep. Yep.
It's a pretty sweet deal, Mike.
It is. It is. I think so. All right. Well, should we move on to our feature for today?
Let's do it.
All right. So we're going to do an audio commentary for an episode of Star Trek Voyager, Living Witness, Season 4, Episode 23. We haven't done any of these yet on this show. I think we've both done a lot of them independently. I've done something like 500 of them. this is an episode of Voyager which was co-written by Brian Fuller, Joe Manosky, and Brandon Braga. And if you look at the IMDb user ratings, this is the highest rated episode that was written by Brian Fuller. So we thought, oh, that's cool. Let's take a look at this episode and see what the best of Brian Fuller Trek up till now looks like. And also, you know, collaboration with Joe Manosky, who is working on the new show. Yep. And, you know, throw a little Brandon Braga in there, because why not? And you get Living Witness.
Yes.
So, we're paused at zero on the counter, whether you're watching it on DVD or Netflix or wherever. And we're going to give a countdown and start up the episode at zero on the count of three. If you're not watching the episode now, that's okay. You'll still be able to follow along. But if you are watching the episode, good for you. So if you're ready, John.
I am ready, Mike.
All right. We'll start this up in 3, 2, 1, start. And there we go. Captain Janeway? What?
Violence. Force must be applied. What?
So
that's not the Janeway I know.
This is a pretty good cold open because it's like, what's going on? Why is her, you know, undershirt black instead of gray? Why is she wearing black leather gloves? And you know, I think in a lot of ways, since they're, I think maybe practically speaking, wasn't like a good way to get them into the mirror universe, this sort of acts as their default mirror universe episode, right?
No, I agree. I mean, it's because the whole concept of the mirror universe is history, but a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing is that, you know, I guess following in the tradition of Star Trek, they just put gloves on and change the undershirt, and it speaks volumes. I mean, think of how iconic the uniform is, that even a minor aesthetic change immediately conveys a complete shift in tone.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty cool.
I was going to say they gave Janeway a new haircut too, but I guess that really doesn't signify anything.
An evil haircut, Mike.
Oh yeah. This haircut's evil. And the lighting is also much darker, you know, than usual.
You know, that is a question that I have though. Why is it always darker on evil ships? One would think that if they're up to no good, nefarious deeds, if you will, that they would want things brightly lit, because usually betrayal and people you can't trust are on evil ships. So why, you know, why wouldn't you have it a little more brightly lit so nobody can pop out and surprise you? Just a thought.
I think you might be thinking about it a little too logically.
Okay, fair enough. That's right. We are on a Voyager, obviously ruled by emotion, and not good emotions either, because we have armed people on the bridge, which is definitely not what we're used to seeing.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, we're thrown into this situation. We don't know what's going on, but it is rather interesting to see this from this perspective, because I think that, you know, one of the things which really works about this episode is that it really is self-contained in a sense, in that there isn't anything where they pull the rug out from underneath us and reset anything. You know, mm-hmm. like we are seeing a simulation that takes place, you know, on a planet 700 years in the future, you know, after Voyager has been long gone. I mean, this is like, you know, chronologically speaking, the last episode of Voyager, the last episode of Star Trek, you know? Nothing has comes after this in any iteration of Star Trek. And yet they never like go back to, you know, regular Voyager and see, you know, like, oh yeah, well here we are, you know, on our way. It's like we get the information about what happened at this particular moment in Voyager's history, but we get it from a different perspective. And I think that that's really, really cool. You know?
Now, what's really interesting is the fact that, and this seems a throwaway, but, you know, with this, when they've frozen everything and you find out that it's a history exhibit that people are watching, you know, simulation, and the guy does have the throwaway line where, you know, he describes Voyager as the most powerful ship of its time. And if you think about it, I suppose you could have the debate about the Defiant, but Voyager was a pretty powerful ship. So it's interesting how, like, I think that's your first cue that this version of history, if you will, that we're watching is based on fact, but skewed. You know, it's a different way of presenting the truth.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the other thing that you need to think about with that line is, like, it seems to be a place in the Delta Quadrant, right? And we see the Voyager with all the extra doodads on it and everything. And, you know, to them, it is the most powerful ship of its time, right? It's got to be, like, even in its current form. Well, okay, I'm sorry, I hate doing this, but we were watching the opening credit sequence right now.
Yes.
This is unparalleled in terms of opening credit sequences for Star Trek shows, you know, in particular, but it's right up there at the top of the list of my favorite opening title sequences in television history. The music, the visuals, everything about this.
Have I ever told you the story about why I love the theme to Voyager probably the most of any of the TV series themes?
I think the theme to Enterprise
is pretty great.
I think you did, but tell it to me again.
Well, the short version of the story is that when my first daughter was born, I would take the afternoons off, and they had this on syndication, and I would put her down, and she would fall asleep and take her afternoon nap while the Voyager credits were going. And this was as guaranteed to put her to sleep as another story from my past, as watching Star Trek V was for me during a difficult time in my life. So Star Trek has a long history of putting the Mills family at rest.
I can definitely see how both Voyager and Star Trek V could put people to sleep.
Now. Star Trek V, because it's a comforting masterwork. But back into the episode, like, we immediately jump in.
Yes.
And we're back at the simulation, the museum.
Yes, we are. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, backstory here, which is interesting, especially since what we're being told is not accurate. And we really don't know how much of it is real or how much of it is, you know, made up, because we have no real touchstone, you know, aside from the Voyager stuff. So when they're talking about their own culture, it's very, you know, ambiguous as to what the truth is.
Now, here's a question for you. That, you know, season four it's fairly deep into the run.
Yeah.
Mirror Mirror happened much earlier, comparatively speaking, with the original series. could they pull off an episode like this, either in today's environment or even at the time that Voyager was airing? Do you think that they can pull this off earlier in the story arc for Voyager? Do you like, does this only work when Voyager has been this established in the timeline?
No, I don't think so. I think you could do this earlier in the run, because Voyager episodes are generally speaking very self-contained, and it's like once you know, like, you know, they're on their way back home. I mean, especially in an episode like this, which really doesn't rely on any sort of character development aside from maybe the Doctor. It's just, it's more about, you know, what we see the characters, or how we see the characters portrayed, you know, that kind of thing, versus how they actually are. I think, you know, you figure that out fairly early on, just like you do with the original series, you know, and it's, you know who Tuvok is, you know who Kim is, and you don't need to have, like, elaborate backstories, you know, associated with these characters to know, like, that it's wrong, you know? It's
right.
They're bad. So I think you could do it early on. I mean, you don't?
No, I was actually just asking out of curiosity. I agree with your assessment, but I always, I don't know, I guess mentally I go back and forth where it's like, I don't think that it wouldn't work earlier. I think that the this type of episode is a payoff for somebody who's been with the show for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is coming home and your wife has a new haircut. You know, for the first time in a year or two. And you're like, oh, well, that's a little different. Oh, yeah, you are as beautiful as I thought you were. You know, like, it's little differences, you know, as John Travolta might say. It's the little differences that stand out. And I think that as a result, a show like this pops more deeper into the run of a series.
Yeah, and I mean, that's definitely true. But I think, you know, there's a long history of sort of, like, alternate realities and in Star Trek shows, whether it's them back on other planets or whatever. So, I mean, you know, like I just watched the other day, I watched an episode of Voyager where the whole thing was like Harry Kim on Earth, you know, and it was like an alternate reality where like something got messed up with the timeline and, you know, Harry Kim didn't get on the Voyager and neither did Tom Paris. And it's like, it was intended to be a first season episode, I believe, but, you know, it aired during season two, but like it didn't, you know, it wasn't confusing or anything to an early viewer. I don't know. Yeah. And here we have the typical, torture scene, which you would find in a Mirror Universe episode.
Or in, well, I mean, nowadays you'd find, this is like an episode of 24.
Yeah, you know? No, that's definitely true. And I know I've said this before, but my friend Zach has a theory that 24 takes place in the Mirror Universe.
I have not heard that before, but that's a pretty great theory.
Yeah.
I kind of like, love that theory. Sense.
Like he said it like on a commentary that we were recording, and I was like, you know what? Brandon Braga, because like Manny Coto and Brandon Braga, they all worked on 24, right?
Yeah.
So like I tweeted Brandon Braga, I'm like, hey, my friend has a theory that 24 takes place in the Mirror Universe of Star Trek. Can you confirm? And he's like, yep, that's accurate. And I'm like, all right, that's canon.
It works now. It absolutely works. Well, the thing is that, and what's great about that is that gives you the opportunity with 24 then to, you know, I don't remember a nuclear bomb going off in Los Angeles. Oh, Mirror Universe. Okay.
Yep.
I don't remember hearing a story about a tiger getting loose from a zoo while somebody was recovering from heroin addiction. Oh, Mirror Universe. That makes sense.
Yep. It works. It works for me. So here, yeah,
the Borg drones.
Yeah.
How interesting a thought is that, that there would be multiple Borg drones?
Well, because at this point, didn't they have, like, the kids who used to be Borg on there or something? Or was that later on, like, Icheb or whatever his name is and the other kids?
I got to be honest, I don't remember. I don't remember. We need, you know what? We need to put a call out to the Journey. To the Journey!
To the Journey.
To help us out.
I'm sure Jerry Ryan was thrilled about having to wear the full Borg makeup again for this episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what are you going to do?
Yeah, you know, that's right. Gosh, Do you think that she got like the, you know, the script and like the details on the episode and just like talked to her agent? She was like, "How many sick days do I have? How can I get out of this?"
You know, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I guess that happens to everyone, you know, sooner or later, whether you're turned into a weird alien thing, you know, 1 week or whatever. But
yeah,
yep, you know.
But at the very least, Harry Kim did not get promoted in this episode.
Yeah, that's
true. Not even in the alternate history.
That's true. That's true. So.
So now we have the inevitable ruthless negotiation scene that is happening, which is, I'm going to say that the ambassadors who show up, I will say that their costumes are, in a sense, to me, vintage Star Trek. They look like something that would have walked right out of the 1960s show.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
So, you know, that's just how it pops to me.
You can tell that they were sort of like getting towards the end of the run and running out of ideas for alien foreheads. Because, like, the one guy, the lizard-looking guy, you know, I think that makeup looks great, right? But these guys with, like, the weird, like, volcanoes on their, you know, between their eyebrows or whatever, with like the little things sticking out of them.
Yeah,
That's a little sketchy, I have to say, and I'm not sure that I'm down with that.
It's definitely though in the great tradition of Star Trek, always feeling that an altered brow ridge was enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, why not move away from the brow ridge and, or maybe supplement it with like some protruding cheekbones or something? You know, just a little something extra.
Yeah,
or even get
true.
Rid of their eyebrows. Why do they have to have eyebrows?
I wonder, you know, I mean, I'm sure that it had something to do with production schedules, you know, right? Because, I mean, you got to make up all these people on the day. So I'm wondering if there's something about foreheads, which was just easier to do than cheekbones or something, you know?
Yeah, I get. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you can. I don't know anything about makeup art, and so anything that I would say would seem dismissive or thinking that it was easier than imagined. But probably that region of, I guess, that region of the face doesn't move as much as like you're, because like when you're talking, your jaw and your cheeks are kind of constantly moving.
Yeah.
So you don't want to put anything that's going to interfere with the actor's voice or that might fall off easy. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
true.
Maybe,
maybe not.
That could be it. That could be it.
But still, why not? Even the chin. Do the chin. Chin could do fine. All right. Anyway, yes. So now we're back again into the museum where the curator is giving us more of the story. Now, with this, usually with the sort of like the mirror universe stuff, they leave you in that situation. I think what really sticks out about this episode, what I think makes it unique and also very not just watchable but rewatchable, is the fact that it pulls out and keeps reestablishing that what you're watching is a museum piece, is artifice. Like, it doesn't do what past mirror universe episodes did, which was sort of like leave you immersed in it.
Right.
It makes it very plain that it's approaching this as a non-real thing. It's not trying to pull the wool over your eyes in any way or say that this is an alternate timeline.
Right. Yeah. And it's also not saying like, let me tell you a story and then just sort of like using this as like a bookend to take you into this. It's very much playing with sort of the idea of storytelling, you know, and saying like, okay, you know, here's what one person is saying, here's what someone else is saying. I do question this museum leaving all of these, you know, ancient artifacts just on like a coffee table where you can just like pick them up and be like, yeah, because, you know, I mean, you look at let's just say displays in, you know, like a movie theater, like they got those giant cardboard displays, right? Mm-hmm. It's like once, you know, one kid's movie is shown, right? If you go into the movie theater after that showing, like, that display is trashed, right? I mean, yep. So like, I can only imagine, you know, like, one kid comes by, "What's this, Mommy?" And ksh, and it's like, "No, that was the priceless artifact from 700 years ago."
Well, perhaps they come from more respectful cultures, Mike. Maybe that's the difference.
Well,
than the movie-going audience. Maybe these people paid to be indoors, and they, you know, it was such an expensive ticket, they don't want to risk getting kicked out.
I mean, I think as we're seeing here, that may not necessarily be the case, right?
Yeah, correct. I agree. I don't have a good answer for that. Like, I would love to come up with a good reason why you would leave something that, because I worked for a brief time, actually in historical preservation library, and there are such weird strictures and rules about what you can touch and interact, even if you're on staff there, that I think you actually raise a really good point. Why wouldn't it at least be, have glass over it? Some sort of something, like a sneeze guard even.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that if someone were to come onto this set, like in real life, they would take greater precautions with, you know, letting people touch these props, these resin props, than these people do with their priceless artifacts. But yeah, what can you do? I do like, you know, with that scene, we're starting to see it here. You know, this episode is definitely not a case of, you know, something which I think a lot of episodes do as a way of, I guess, shorthand in terms of, like, presenting conflicts between, you know, races that we've never seen before, where it's like, these guys are blaming these guys, but in reality, it's the first guys who did the thing, and because they're the real bad guys. Like, this one, I mean, there's that to it. But there's a lot of, like, sort of, like, complexity to their relationship with each other in that, you know, neither of them are all good or all bad. They both have done, you know, admirable things, and they both have done terrible things. And it's not a straight, like, good versus evil conflict. It's more of two varying races and two varying opinions. And it's not really about who's right or who's wrong. It's more about finding a place where they can, you know, meet in the middle, which is, you know, ultimately what happens in this episode. Spoilers.
Well, but I think that to speak to that point also is it very much addresses this idea of the people who are wrong about history, who are presenting history in a skewed fashion. Like, the museum curator is not doing it. He doesn't have any ill intent. He is presenting simply what he believes to be true. And I think it also shows a great lesson where, when confronted with things being wrong, his first reaction is to say, no, that's not what I've known my whole life. Like, I think that's a very normal, and yes, I know they're all aliens and it's blah, 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 but, like, it's a very normal human reaction when your whole worldview is challenged, to respond with it as, whoa, hey, let's slow down here. I'm not so sure you're right about that. Like, it's a completely, like, your first reaction in any situation like that, your mind is going to try to protect itself and say, no, what I understand to be true is true, and I do not wish it to be violated, because if it is, then everything comes crumbling down. So, you know, it's... I think what is the greatest part about the episode is that it treats that stuff, as you said, so delicately. And, you know, with respect to the fact that it's more complex than, you know, compared to the original series episode, with the one with Frank Gorshin. I always forget the title of it. Your mirror images of each other. Right. Can't you see
the white,
that one?
The white and black and the black and white. And
right.
I'm forgetting the name of the episode.
I always say it's the one with the Riddler in it.
It's the one episode of the original series that Darren Moser has seen.
Ah, well, there you go. Darren, give us a shout. Let us know what episode we're forgetting to name here.
That's not true, but I always make fun of him for it. But yeah, you know, I mean, you're right about that, and I think that it is interesting how they show that growth here with this character. You know, again, it's not like a one-dimensional character here. You know, he is completely resistant to the idea, and you think that, you know, the conflict in this episode, especially since, you know, the Doctor is the one real character, you know, who's a regular who we're seeing. Like, he's going to need to convince this guy of his point of view, and, you know, the guy's not going to be listening, and how is the Doctor going to do that? When, in reality, even though that's how it starts, it's once the guy shuts him up by turning him off and starts thinking about it on his own, he basically comes to the conclusion himself, or at least makes the decision to listen to what the Doctor has to say, because it really doesn't do any good to just shut up the person who you think is going to shatter that worldview. You know, listen to them and, mm-hmm. and you know, see whether or not your worldview stands up to the challenge, to the test, you know, because maybe it won't, you know.
Well, yeah, it's the whole idea of the Athenian Forum. Everybody gets a voice,
mm-hmm.
but you have to let everybody speak. Yeah. You know, in order to do exactly what you're saying. But I do want to say that I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the Doctor is the one character we see as themselves, you know, in this episode. And, you know, what a fascinating concept of being Rip Van Winkle, mm-hmm. you know, 700 years later, how everybody's gone. And not only is everybody gone, you're not even anywhere close to where you're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Like, it's 7 centuries later. And you're on an alien planet. Like, that's got to be crazy. But I think that Picardo's performance is really good in this episode. Like, it really, he is a great actor. I don't think that that is breaking news to anybody. But this is one of those episodes where he's really given a chance to shine, and he comes through in spades.
Yeah, the Doctor episodes tend to be some of the best episodes of Voyager. And I think a lot of that has to do with the nature of the character, but I think more of that has to do with his performance, you know, his performances. He is really solid for sure. You know,
now we're at the point in the episode, if you're not watching along, where Janeway has done the classic bad captain thing and, you know, fired the gun to get the attention of the crew members who are fighting. But she shoots and you see the display, you know, get damaged and turn off. Another question about evil people ships. Like, are their tech crews just insanely good? Because, you know, it's like, boot. Oh, geez, they shot it again. Okay, get the display up there. Or do you think that that's like almost like a dummy display? Like, the real computer is like hidden off in the corner. They're like, we know she's going to shoot. Let's give her a big target to shoot so she doesn't shoot anything sensitive.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, looking at it, I think that she very strategically shot right above the display so as not to destroy it itself, right?
But once everybody was onto that trick, I mean, like, you know, they would all know, hey, wait a minute, she's not actually damaging displays. Maybe she, or, you know, I don't know. I'm probably thinking about evil ships too much.
Maybe she's just trying to make a loud noise, you know? It's like firing a gun up in the air, but she doesn't want to fire it above her because, you know.
Would it go through the deck? I mean, it didn't go through the wall.
Yeah,
I don't. But I would have met. What if it went through the deck and, like, somebody, some crewman was just, like, walking around, all of a sudden a phaser beam comes up and hits them? Another problem with evil ships.
I imagine that the phasers do not go through the decks because, like, You always see that problem in, you know, you see it in movies today where it's like, don't fire a gun in this airplane because, you know, it'll decompress the cabin, you know. But they never seem to worry about that on starships, and everyone is carrying guns all the time and they're just firing them all willy-nilly, you know, unless...
Structural integrity fields, Mike.
Right. So, you know, I think... You know, like, there, I was even just watching an episode, I think it was The Adversary from Deep Space Nine, where they're like, we're going to do, like, a wide dispersal pattern, but it's going to be enough to stun the changeling, but not enough to damage the structural integrity of the whatever. You know, so I think that they probably don't really harm the ship, at least not to the point of putting a hole through the hull. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Mm. Now, here's a question, though. Speaking of the weaponry, It's interesting to me when the ambassadors get shot in this episode that the gun seems to be like a slow acting kill. It's not like a shot fall over, like they suffer for a little bit. And to me, that's sort of evocative of Star Trek III, mm-hmm. when Krug shoots the crew member who disobeys him. And, it's a slow death for him.
Well, I think probably, you know, what we're seeing here is, you know, they didn't know exactly how these phasers worked. And, someone had to program this, just like someone had to, you know, direct and act this actual episode out in the real world. So I could see it being a case of just like, you know, Tim Russ, for example, who was the director on this episode, decided to play it in a certain way for dramatic effect. Whoever Sure. the hologram programmer was at the museum did the same thing, you know? The Tim Russ of this planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the line revisionist history. It's such a comfort.
Yeah.
It's such a brilliant, there are so many brilliant lines like that throughout this episode,
mm-hmm.
That are just amazing. And it, how could you possibly challenge like a hologram? You know, this is even more reliable than Spock. You know, I'm a Vulcan, I never lie. But then he's like, you know, well, you know, it's not really, you know, he does the Obi-Wan Kenobi thing with the whole concept of lying constantly. Mm-hmm. Whereas a computer program, the Doctor, he really is incapable of lying to you, isn't he? Or is he? I mean, once something achieves a certain level of artificial intelligence, wouldn't it be able to lie, at least in the sense of trying to preserve itself?
Well, I think that's one of the things that he sort of realizes here. He's like, why would a program which is, you know, created to be a doctor have, you know, any reason to lie? Like, why would he be programmed to lie? That doesn't seem to benefit, you know, anything when you start thinking about, you know, this person, you know, this artificial person. So even though maybe they have, you know, holograms which would lie, this one doesn't. Why would a hologram designed for medical purposes be programmed to lie so readily? You know, there you go.
So, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he probably doesn't even know that the Doctor has, you know, reached a certain level of sentience or whatever by this point on the show. But, yeah, I don't know. It's
Now, see, it's interesting there. Just great scene, you know, with the curator, you know, questioning himself, questioning everything. Why would he be programmed to lie so easily? But you'll notice the fallback of the very Star Trek, you know, by this point after Next Generation, the very Star Trek concept of, you know, hitting my recording badge on my shirt.
Yeah.
Why would this culture, an alien culture 700 years in the future, have anything approaching the same interface technology that, you know, we're familiar with? Obviously it's visual shorthand because as the audience, I get that part of it. But it's so interesting to me to see sort of how, you know, the interface technology, that's almost a leap that nobody really thinks to take into account and say, oh, well, the interface would actually be probably different for these people.
Yeah, you would think that they would use something else. I mean, I could definitely see that being something which lasts another 700 years. I mean, we're just now starting to develop wearables, and I'm sure, I mean, hey, we just got a working communicator, so, you know, like a Bluetooth, you know, flip phone communicator thing. I'm sure that the wearable functioning, you know, 24th century communicator will be coming to you from Think Geek next Christmas. You know what I mean?
Well, I know, but it's so funny to me. And this isn't a dig at you, but like just in general, like we're sort of like so conditioned with like the communicator and stuff like that. Like I always, when I think of the communicator or it being cited as a technological, you know, the sort of thing, I always think of Skyfall when he holds up the little radio and he goes, radio, it's the latest thing. You know, it's like, you know, it's a walkie-talkie.
Yeah.
It's really not that special.
That's true.
It's the network that we imagine that it can create this big mesh network of everything. That's the special part.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the flip phone thing. Like, for years and years, I was like, I need a flip phone because that's what Captain Kirk has. You know, I insisted on it. When I had to switch to, you know, an iPhone, I was very resistant, and I spent a long time trying to find, and I actually did find a flip phone, which was made out of, you know, some sort of weird aluminum stuff that they used to make, like, the arch in St. Louis or something. I don't know what it was. It was some weird thing. And
so you went in search of a drug dealer's phone just to be like Captain Kirk?
Yeah, well, at the time, everyone had them, you know?
Oh, okay.
I mean, to me, like, the ultimate in cell phone, you know, design is really, like, the Razor, the Motorola Razor, you know?
Not the Crazer?
No.
The Razor, not the Crazer.
Yeah.
Because the Razor's wide. The Crazer, if anybody forgets, was basically, like, the thinner. There was a little more, like, it was a little bit thicker, but it was a thinner one. It was, it fit in your palm a little bit easier.
Yeah.
But you like the Razor itself instead of the Crazer.
Yeah, it's so iconic. I still have my Razor. Okay. But, you know, whatever. So, yes, I don't understand why they haven't made, like, an original series communicator case for, like, iPhones. It doesn't make any sense to me. Because I had this one that I actually won. I was, like, debating, like, do I get it? Because it was, like, expensive. And then they had one of those things where it's, like, retweet for a chance to win. And I'm like, oh, let me retweet. And then they're like, you won. I'm like, oh, yeah. And I used it. And I'm like, this is actually not very practical at all. But it sure looks cool.
And you learned a special lesson, just like the episode Living Witness.
Yes, that's true.
That sometimes what you imagine is not quite the same thing as reality.
Yeah, although looking at it, I'm like, you could totally make this work. You know, why don't they make this work? But what can you do?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to me because I want to ask you sort of like on the whole, do you think that everybody was successful in presenting the evil version of their character? And I know that that's tough because they don't appear as the evil versions through the entire thing. But do you think that the actors were successful in conveying a real difference? Could you really see a difference in their mannerisms or their vocal inflections or anything like that? I mean, Tuvok obviously is smiling evilly in his one scene and close up and everything like that. But, you know, would it have worked had they not changed the lighting? Would you have still been able to tell the difference between the versions of these characters?
Yeah, I think they did a pretty good job. And I think the stuff that they give them to do, you know, really sort of helps with that. I think the only two people who don't really have things to do, which make it blatantly obvious, are Tuvok and, you know, I mean, well, like they say with Paris, like, well, he kind of was like that already, you know, which I thought was a funny line. You know, it was weird because, like, you know, rewatching this again today, every time Tuvok would do something, I'd be like, oh, that's such an actorly choice. Like, that's a bizarre choice to make. I don't think that he quite understood what everyone else was going for. And then I was like, wait a minute. He directed this episode himself, so he knew exactly what he was doing and what everyone else was doing. But I think it was still maybe not the best choice, you know? But, yeah, I don't have a problem with it, really. It's weird because naturally this type of episode is going to be, even though it's dealing with some, you know, pretty serious subject matter, and even though these people are supposed to be evil, like anytime there's like a mirror episode or whatever, it's naturally going to be fun for the viewer because of the differences, because you're looking for the differences and you're spotting the differences and you're like, oh, hey, look how they changed that guy. Oh, hey, you know, it's fun seeing the evil version of Janeway and that sort of thing. But I think this episode does a really good job of sort of balancing that fun with this, you know, really sort of dense message And it does a good job of presenting more than just a fun episode, you know? Mm-hmm. It works on a lot of different levels, you know, very, very well. It's a really great episode on the whole.
I completely agree. Now, here's a question, though. It's something I'm thinking of here because the Doctor, as he's showing everybody, you know, the way history really happened and saying, you know, here's the evidence, here's where you can access the evidence, here's everything, you know, I'm not just trying to save my own skin. Why did it take them so long to, again, I know, unimportant, but why did it take them so long to decode his backup program module? You know, like, come on, man.
Well, you know, I mean, I think part of it was, I mean, like, the guy talks about how he's like, I've been trying to do this and I haven't really, you know, figured out how to do it, but maybe if I go into the engineering program and use their tools, I'll be able to fix it. I don't really know how much sense that makes. But, I mean, they do say at the beginning of the episode, like, when he's talking to the guy who's like, how do you know that this is real? He's like, we just found a thing buried in the ground, you know, like at 900 feet or whatever. So it sounds like they just discovered this thing, you know, the backup module, you know, fairly recently. It's not like
Fair
they
point.
Had it for like 700 years or whatever.
And now I feel like a chump because I had forgotten that factoid. My apologies.
It happens, you know.
Yeah.
It's one of those things.
I need to watch better. That's what needs to happen. But I still think it's a fantastic episode anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is really interesting just the fact that it graduates in this scene that we're watching right now into like the actual the venomous part of it. Like it because the curator is the one, you know, who has the journey where he says, okay, I'm going to believe him. I'm going to go with it. We're going to recreate things. We're going to show it to everybody. And then you start to see sort of the, like it starts small with one person's mind changing and then represents it to show how hard it is. Like you can change one person's mind, but then to change an entire cultural perception of history is a whole different challenge. Like once you take to the next level, and that's where I think, it, you know, for my money, that's where, one of the places where the writing really, really shines in this episode is that it does that. It moves out in those sort of concentric circles where it starts off with the small problem and then it graduates to the bigger problem so that you present the same argument twice in different contexts to show how it plays in both of them.
Yeah. And it is so complex with, you know, the two different sides of the issue, you know, and it's not like, you know, because there's one side which is trying to protect their legacy, but at the same time, like they're not the, you know, dominant species in this particular pairing. It's the mm-hmm. other side. They're the ones who are essentially fighting for the truth, but they're not the ones who are like oppressed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the oppressed people are the ones who are like trying to hold on to like the, you know, one piece of history, which they feel like, you know, in a sense, you know, I'm not going to say redeems them, you know, but like, It's very strange how like the two sides like clash, and like it's not the, you know, let's say good guys are right and the bad guys are wrong, or these are good guys and these are bad. I don't know. There's a lot of, you know, interesting stuff which is sort of built on top of this idea of what the truth is and whether or not it matters and stuff.
Well, to get, I guess, all meta tricks about it,
mm-hmm.
Shout out, guys. I would say that maybe there's an interesting question being presented that, you know, the resistance to it on the part of the, you know, oppressed side would be if this history that we've believed is not true, then our suffering has been for nothing. Maybe that's the angle that you can sort of look at it from, where it's like, I don't want this not to be true, because if so, that means we've really been screwed for several hundred years.
Yeah.
Like that's really awful.
Or we brought this upon ourselves.
Right.
You know, whereas right. like the other group, you know, they're like, you know, what you're saying is lies, you know, but it's like, they're not the ones like censoring what's being said. You know, it's in fact, the other ones, they're like, we want the truth to be known. You know, you messed with us and we fought back and we won, you know? I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there's just there's a lot going on there, you know, and, yeah. and it starts, you know, what's going on here, which is this race riot as you know, the doctor describes it, which is maybe not tremendously convincing in its execution, but whatever. But here, you know, I mean, we have this thing where they talk about, like, what's going on, you know, the protests and everything and people getting killed, and the doctor is freaking out about it because he sees himself as the one responsible. And, you know, his initial reaction here of just, like, I'm going to delete myself because I didn't want this to happen, you know?
Right.
I think that that's really interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of parallels to what's going on, you know, now, actually, with this, where he's like, I just want us to go back to the way it was before. And, you know, it's the other guy who's like, no, you know, we need to make sure that people know the truth so that this kind of crap doesn't continue to happen, because just ignoring it is not going to make it go away, you know?
Right.
But if we confront it head on and we say, hey, this is what happened, you know, we need to think about what we feel to be the truth or whatever, and maybe reevaluate the way that the world is, then maybe we can actually create change. And it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be very messy. But in the end, you know, it'll be better. We will have a better world. And I think that that's really interesting. You know, it's interesting from a philosophical, you know, standpoint, but it's also interesting from a structural standpoint, especially the way that, like, Star Trek episodes usually work, because it's the Doctor, the main character, the one main character, who's the one who's like, screw this, I'm out. And it's right. the other guy who's like, no, you can't do that. We need to stand up for this and do what's right and, you know, create change. And then they do. So yeah, I think that's really cool. And this scene, just in general, I think is really interesting, because, you know, they do that last little twist where, you know, coming up, we see that this is the simulation now, and we're even further into the future. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, here's the point where you think that they're going to maybe go back to Voyager and be like, oh, man, that was crazy. I don't know how they would do that, honestly. I'm just shocked that they didn't, because it's like, is this the only time in Star Trek that they haven't done that? I mean, there's no other episode of Star Trek like this, you know, where they do anything like this. Now we're even further into the history, into the future, you know?
Right.
And it's just such a great, you know, sort of like extra layer. It's like, you know, Star Trek Voyager Inception, you know? And it's yeah. it's pretty awesome how they do this. They still haven't learned their lesson. They're still keeping that freaking tricorder out on the coffee table. I don't understand that.
I don't understand how fashions can't advance that much more.
That's true.
Just throwing that out there.
That's true. But, you know, they did get that nice picture, which I'm sure they bought from the creation booth at the latest convention. I'm sure you can still buy that picture, you know, at conventions.
Oh, yeah.
Cast photo from whatever season.
Yep.
But, yeah, it's an awesome episode, you know?
Naturally, I completely agree. There's... Truly great episodes of Star Trek remain resonant many years after they were aired. And this is one of the ones where, with regards to the entire run of every series of Trek, this is a standout. I would point to this one as, and everybody knows, I'm not a particular fan of Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an episode where I would say, if you want to watch essential Star Trek, this is part of the conversation for it.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I mean, like, I'm not a huge fan of Voyager either. I do think that, like, seasons 4, 5, and 6 are very good, and, you know, I pretty much, like, aside from the first couple of years, I pretty much watched them all straight through when the DVDs came out. I just watched them one right after another over the span of, like, a couple months, so they all just kind of blended together in a lot of ways, and I don't remember a lot of specific episodes from some points in the run. And, you know, when Brian Fuller was announced as the showrunner of Disco, I went back and I looked at the list of all the episodes that he had done, and most of them I was like, I don't know what that is, I don't know what that is, I don't know what that is. And, you know, going on to things like the IMDb or, you know, Geos when it still existed, I guess.
The what?
Geos. Have you ever heard of Geos?
I've heard of GeoCities.
No.
But not Geos.
Geos is like the global episode something system, global episode rank. Basically what it is it's a is they've got a bunch of TV shows, you know, mostly genre things, and yeah, they break each show down into its individual episodes, and then you can rank the individual episodes of every show. You know, not every show, but, you know, of a lot of shows.
So sort of like Letterboxd, but for TV episodes.
Sort of like that. I mean, it's more like the IMDb ratings, but just, I mean, it's almost exactly like that. But more than that, like the way it's structured, it's like, hey, you know, here's a list of the top 10 episodes of Voyager. You know, here's a list of the top 10 episodes of Deep Space Nine or whatever, you know, you know, I mean, you look at those and you get a pretty good idea of what, you know, fans consider to be the best episodes of certain shows, you know, just like on IMDb. And, you know, Living Witness is the episode that kept on, you know, coming up as the top rated episode that Fuller wrote. So, you know, I went back and watched it and I hadn't really remembered it. I kind of, you know, vaguely remembered it, but, you know, watching it, you know, sort of intently with, you know, the idea that this is the guy who's, you know, making the new Star Trek show in mind, I was kind of blown away and thought, you know, like if this were in Next Gen or something like that, it would probably be a standout to me. It probably would be one of my favorite episodes of the series or of the franchise. And, you know, I'm kind of glad that, you know, I was able to rediscover it through circumstance, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Good episode, and excited that that both Fuller and Minoski are involved in this new show, for sure.
Yeah. If this is any indication, we are in for some really good things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is cool. We'll have to go in and maybe look at, you know, maybe Minoski's top-rated episode, you know, in a while.
Ooh,
or something
I'm
like that.
I'm down with that, man. You know,
that could be fun. But in the meantime, it's been fun talking about Living Witness today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Well, if you can see the Vulcan ship design is reflected in the 24th century, and that's just mainly quarters. So that's pretty much what Starfleet adopts in future ships.
The Orb.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I could move to England, and before you know it, I'd be singing "Oh," and eating bangers and eggs every morning. So,
and then you'd go back to America. You would make your Megxit, and it would be over. So.
That's right. That's right. My Megxit. That's right. Matt is leaving Britain.
Melodic Treks.
But this was the album that, when that electric violin shows up right in track one, there, I literally tilted my head back, smiled, and went, yes.
Saturday Morning Trek.
What I had to assure the fans when I talked at the convention or conventions was, this is not going to be a kiddie show. This is not going to be a baby show. We are doing Star Trek. And we are able to do Star Trek in some ways a better way, because we could have wonderful spaceships, we could have wonderful aliens, wonderful planets, and we still had good stories.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. See, we should change that script now to say, check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in favorite corner of the Star Trek universe.
You've got to do it.
All right.
You've got to do it.
It's done. It's done right there. We just did it.
Yes.
On the air. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You'll find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Before we go, we need to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter and Chris Steftenagel, for their support of Stage 9. Thank you guys very much. We couldn't do it without you. If you want to be like Chris and Jeff, you can become a patron of the network on patreon.com/trekfm. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Another way that you can help us out is to leave us a review on iTunes, and we're actually having a contest going on right now through the end of the month. August 31st will be the cutoff date, let's say midnight central time, because that's where I am. You're in Eastern, but you know, this way the people in Central
Time, our time moves too quickly for most.
Yeah.
So I would say Central Time is a good compromise.
Okay. So Central Time, August 31st, put in a review on iTunes, and you will be entered into our contest to win the IMAX Marathon exclusive Star Trek Beyond poster, which is a very, very nice full, you know, one sheet size poster. And
yes.
We would definitely appreciate that. And we have another review this week, don't we?
We do have another review from Sonic J-Row 5 that says, great podcast. It's 5 stars, so thank you very much. Deeply appreciated. And they said, another great Trek FM podcast. Mike and John give us wonderful info and insights into the people that make Star Trek. Thank you very much for the review. We appreciate it very much. Not just that people are listening, but that they're saying such kind things about the show. We really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. If you want to contact us in some other way other than iTunes, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. Let us know what your favorite Brian Fuller episode of Star Trek is. I'm curious to see what Voyager fans especially consider to be his finest work. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Kessel Junkie, mainly on Twitter. And you can find me on Aggressive Negotiations, the Star Wars podcast with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing, and on Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. Where can they find you, Mike?
You can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, which is Trek FM's daily rewatch of Star Trek.
And is a finalist for an award.
For the Parsec Awards,
For the Parsec Awards. Well-deserved. I think everybody should take a moment to give Mike a round of applause for that show, which is a great deal of fun to listen to. And if you haven't started yet, there's still time.
Yeah, there is for sure. Well, I mean, thank you for that, but also thank you to you and everyone else on the network who has helped out with it. You know, I counted just in the eligibility period, just in the first 121 episodes, which is what we were nominated for, there were 21 people who helped with this show. So,
wow.
You know, it's by no means, you know, just me. And I thank everyone on Trek FM and everyone out there who listens to it, because that's if you weren't listening to it, I'd be like, all right, let's not do this anymore. because it's a lot of work. So you can find me doing that show. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, that pretty much wraps up Living Witness. Now, next week, John, you're going to be taking a much needed vacation.
I'm going to Risa to go sit on the beach and play my flute. Yes, as all great bald captains do.
Okay, don't forget your horgon. I can't believe I actually knew what that was called. Because when I was at Vegas, there was a guy, like literally, I was like, what is this guy doing? Because it was a bald guy who was wearing a Speedo and an open robe. And he was just walking around the bar. And I'm like, I wonder what his deal is. And then I saw that he had a horgon. And I'm like, I get it.
There you go.
I'm like, look, he has his thing. And he comes up to me. He's like, yes, are you looking for love or whatever? And I'm like, I'm good for now, but I'll let you know.
Thank you. Maybe in another couple of drinks.
Thank you for the offer. Yeah. Yes, don't forget your horgon. So I think that's what it's called. Anyway.
I just like hearing you say the word.
Regardless, I will be back next week with someone, I'm not exactly sure who, we'll find out, to talk about a new movie from written by a Star Trek actor, Hell or High Water, which also stars Chris Pine. And we're going to be talking about that and the first movie in this American Frontier Trilogy, as they're calling it, Sicario. So come back next week, and we're going to be talking about Taylor Sheridan's Sicario and Hell or High Water.